Robinhood Radio welcomes you to David Freeman's Science Insider with your host, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, David Freeman.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to Science Insider. Today, I'm really honored to have as our guest one of America's great spaceflight heroes, Dr. Buzz Aldrin. So welcome, Buzz.
Well, thank you very much. Real nice to talk to you. I'm in Washington, D.C. right now between meetings and looking forward to sharing my ideas.
Okay, well, great. So I guess it's been about, I know you've answered these questions a million times before, but I hope you'll indulge me. I guess it's been about 45 years now since you became the second man to set foot on the moon right after Neil Armstrong. And I won't ask you what that felt like, but what did that look like? Can you tell me the experience of stepping out? What did it look like to you?
Well, it just to go back just a little bit, it is going to be 45 years on the 20th of July of this year, which is a Sunday. I do hope to use that as a time where the president might restate or state again his objectives for space in the second term. So the anniversaries of 45 and especially of 50 coming up in 2019 are quite significant, I think, in their opportunities for reviewing and restating what our longer-term objectives might be. I know Mike Collins would like to, I'm sure, participate, and we're both sorry that that Neil won't be here for this 45th and also for the 50th anniversary. We kind of said as a group that we'd really like to see that 50th come about.
Mike Collins was the pilot of the command module while you and Neil Armstrong were on the moon.
His wife has suffered a stroke, so he's taking care of her a good bit, and I'm wiping up the remnants of a almost 3-year divorce settlement.
Well, before we talk about what I know you have very specific ideas about what you think the U.S. should be doing, but take us back there. Take us back if you would a bit before the landing.
Yeah.
Was it really as hairy as we've been led to believe that you guys were about out of fuel?
Well, I think there's a lack of appreciation for what the difficult parts of the mission really were in comparison to the symbolic nature of a human actually walking on the surface. The landing of the spacecraft was, I think, the most difficult thing in space program activities that that the U.S. or any nation has carried out. And without successfully doing that, there is no opportunity for symbolism on the moon in that landing attempt and the ones after that. But the first landing paves the way for all sorts of activities on that landing and subsequent ones. To be specific, the president said, I believe this nation should commit itself within the decade of landing a man on the moon and bringing him back safely.
Right.
So that includes one person looking out the window and taking some pictures and coming back safely. Obviously, we felt the redundancy of having two people helping each other and that we were capable, once having landed, of being able to not only put one person out, but to put two people out. Previous spacewalks had already always been done by one person, and they'd been done by the junior member of the crew because the crucial activities of the mission demanded the training of the commander to execute those very crucial portions of the mission. So usually the experiments were the primary concern of the junior member on the space, now on the crew. Now, of course, when you're landing and doing something for the very first time by a nation, by the world, by humanity, the symbolism of the first step on the moon is extremely important and was decided correctly, without a doubt, that that the commander should be doing that. And the experiments on the surface were led essentially by Neil also. That could have been differently handled, I believe, but just like taking pictures should have been rehearsed a whole lot more. And there's certain scenery things that we would want to take and pictures of each other. That wasn't rehearsed enough, so it didn't turn out the way we'd like it to be. Neil made his statement on walking on the moon, one small step for man, a giant leap for mankind. I didn't have to prepare anything, but when I got down to the surface, one of the meaningful statements that I made was magnificent desolation.
Right.
And the magnificence is like the small step for man, but a giant leap for mankind. The magnificence of human beings being able to progress on the surface of the earth to the point where we could transport ourselves to another object in the sky and actually begin to move around on that surface was indeed a magnificent tribute to the progress of humanity. But in looking out at what was in front of us, not only was it the easiest, the simplest, the flattest place to land, but it was the most desolate when you realize that it hasn't changed in hundreds of thousands of years, except for very small changes by the very small meteorite impacts that are making that are happening all the time. But the stark contrast between the very sunlit surface, the distinctness of the horizon as the surface curved away from you against the very velvety black background that had so much light that there wasn't any way to see stars in a sunlight condition. We could look way up above us and see the Earth up there. But it was just a total lifeless, still, of course, there's no sound, but just a very desolate, I use the word, not a very good place to set up housekeeping, because you've got 13, 14 days of increasing and then decreasing sunlight, and it gets very, very hot. And then when the sun goes down, it gets very, very cold for another 13, 14 days.
Well, let me ask you this. Once I heard you say, and I wasn't sure at the time if you were joking, that when you stepped out, you were very careful to leave the hatch door open. Surely there was a mechanism to prevent you from being locked out.
Oh, yeah. Well, when we decreased the pressure in the cabin, when we had all the equipment on our backs and all ready to go outside, we depressurized the cabin, and it went down to about zero on the gauge, but the hatch still wouldn't open until it kept outgassing a little bit more, and then finally we could pull the door open against the very light residual pressure on the inside. So a small amount of pressure could hold that door shut.
Right.
All right. Now, the checklist did say, as I went out, to reach back and partially close the hatch. I don't know whether it said being careful not to lock it on the way out.
Well, that would have been a bad thing.
But I sort of added that for a contrast of humor, and then added being careful not to lock it on my way out. There was not a handle on the outside, so there was no way really to, if the pressure had leaked inside, for us to get back in again.
Wow. Well, let me ask you this. Before you became such a household name for your setting foot on the moon, I believe you were, if I'm not mistaken, you were also the first U.S. astronaut to do a spacewalk back in the Gemini program in the 60s. Is that earlier in the 60s?
Yes. Well, I applied for astronaut profession the year before, but I didn't have the qualifications. I had not attended test pilot training. And the next opportunity in 63, I was selected, and I believe there were a few more that were selected in our group of 14 who also had not had test pilot training. So there was distinctly a shift at that point. The backgrounds that we had, I happened to have had a background of scuba diving for almost 8 years before. So when the sequence of progressive spacewalking opportunities from Ed White, the next one was Dave Scott, but he didn't even get a chance to do that because he and Neil had a stuck thruster. Then Gemini 9 was not too successful because of the overexertion. Gemini 10 was Mike Collins using the handheld maneuvering unit, moving over to sort of a dead Agena rocket that John Young had flown close to, and then coming back, he had a little trouble with the umbilical getting back in again, but he didn't move to the back of the spacecraft, which seemed to be the big challenge, and certainly was on the next mission, Gemini 11, plus a visor problem, and attaching the tether between the Agena rocket and the Gemini spacecraft. So there were a number of things that were interrupting, but I was already training underwater when Gemini 11 lifted off, and I felt very confident that the neutral buoyancy and the improved foot restraints would enable me to do quite difficult tasks in the back of the spacecraft adapter, and I felt confident about the number one experiment that the Air Force had on the Gemini program, which was the astronaut maneuvering unit. So it was quite a disappointment for me when NASA decided to cancel that when I was halfway through my neutral buoyancy training. Yes, we did have a very successful series of three spacewalks, but I felt that I could have done much more than I was able to if we'd kept that more complex maneuvering unit on the mission instead of canceling it in favor of a number of very small, simple tasks to do in the spacecraft.
But since you know what it's like to spacewalk, I'm wondering what you've seen the movie Gravity, and I'm wondering what you think they got right and what they got wrong about being in space like that.
Well, I think in general the activities that showed inside Sandra Bullock moving about inside and initially in the outside where they were close to the spacecraft, those were quite normal, very well portrayed with special effects and whatever gave them. When they began to have emergencies where they were floating off and getting to the end of the tether and then spinning, I'm sure that the producers came pretty close to the laws of physics in what objects would, how they would behave if they were at the end of tethers. It certainly looked sensational to the crowd, and I mean to the viewers, and probably they appreciated the hazards of space, even though those were hopefully not going to be the hazards you'd ever encounter. I think the collision with other objects was a little bit over dramatized, and going from one spacecraft to another and then re-entering began to have details of not really genuinely repeating what could have happened. But I think in general it was an excellent portrayal, and it set the appreciation in the general public's mind of the hazards that space could produce when things went wrong, and we certainly hope that they wouldn't get wrong that way.
Right. Well, there is a concern about all the space debris, and that's building up. I guess there, maybe you know the number. Do you know how many pieces of orbital debris and how many satellites there are up there now?
No. It's a very big place up there, and we have an excellent cataloging and tracking of all the objects above of a certain very small size, and maneuvering the space station is done frequently. Well, not too frequently, because of the presence of small amounts of debris that could cause some problems. A massive explosion or destruction of an object, like when the Chinese destroyed one of their satellites in a anti-satellite mission test, that created quite a bit of debris that had to be dealt with.
Right. So, did seeing that movie, did that make you want to go back into space? I'm wondering if you want to go to Mars. There's a lot of talk about colonizing Mars today.
Well, I certainly won't be alive when that happens, but I am working feverishly as best I can to clear the way toward the U.S. maintaining a leadership that we clearly had during Apollo. I did want to make one small point, that whenever I'm introduced to a crowd of people to talk about almost anything, I'm always the second man on the moon instead of a member of the first lunar landing crew, which,
right,
since the landing is far more important than going down the ladder and then making various statements. This is symbolic position for Neil. I don't think it mandates me being known as the second for the rest of my life.
Well, let me ask you that. This is funny because I've thought about this. I believe when Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay made it to the top of Everest, I believe they made it a point never to reveal who actually set foot on the summit first. Could that have been done with, with Apollo 11?
No, it wasn't an option, it shouldn't have been that way. But whatever the procedure was that we did would be the same carried out in all the subsequent missions.
And so what about Mars? I mean, there's a lot of talk about Mars One, which has the idea that there's a group of people who are going to train to go to Mars to become on a one-way trip.
Yeah, I'm quite aware of that, and I have, I guess, until the early 80s, have concerned myself with maybe some better ways of getting to the moon. It didn't involve how to better put somebody on the surface of the moon, but how to fly by in a continuous way that would be useful for adventure travelers to fly by the backside or the front side of the moon. And when that wasn't of much interest to the government, I was asked Tom Payne, the administrator of NASA, when we landed on the moon, to start looking about Mars, and it began doing that, thinking it would be very difficult. It turned out to be not that difficult. The same principles apply. So in short order, I came up with a way that you could depart Earth on a continuous trajectory and fly by Mars about 5-6 months later, and then come back to the Earth 21 months later, or a total of 26 months, which is the time that Earth and Mars are in position again to execute a transfer. And when that happens, Mars is going around once and the Earth's going around twice. And that has turned out to be the only way of doing a cycling orbit, and that was in 1985. That's been known as the Aldrin orbit since then. I've worked closely with Purdue, and since then a graduate student has come up with the next logical opportunity, which is every other synodic period, meaning you need two cycling spacecraft, but it tremendously improves the departure and arrival of velocities, so that they're much easier to accommodate the fuel needed to catch up or to rendezvous with the cycler. and the speed of entering the Martian surface, the Martian atmosphere, to make a landing. Not only that, but you have an encounter of the Earth a year and a half before the next flyby of the Earth that goes to Mars, and that opens up tremendous opportunities for resupply, for initial construction. So I think the cycling system is vastly improved. What is not improved is the receptivity of the government, NASA, and other companies because of not invented here. I'm sure you've heard of that, that if a good idea is brought up to some people, if they didn't think of it, they won't think it's a very good idea. Even though that was way back in 1985 when the concept of continuous delivery system and continuous radiation protection and facilities for dealing with people in the transit from Earth to Mars as being reusable over and over and over again.
But what is the point of going to Mars? Is it to establish a colony, to get the Earth into make humans a multi-planet species? What exactly is the point?
It's sort of all of those. The short term, let's say in 50 years, nations will reach Mars. There's no doubt that Russia will want to do that, that China will want to do that. Now, the United States, 45 years ago, had clear leadership in space transportation systems. We have fallen back in that for varieties of reasons, so we're not number one in doing that anymore. Temporarily, we can't even launch any of our government or private people into space to our own $100 billion space station, yet the Russians can continue to launch and the Chinese can continue to launch and build their respective space stations. So we've declined considerably, and I think there are opportunities of reversing that trend. Will have tremendous impact on our education system and inspiration system of the younger people. In the 60s and 70s, nobody ever heard of the term STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math. But we've lost our position, the United States, and now everyone is concerned about how we can increase our education in these subjects and include the arts.
The Apollo program and the space program of the 60s and 70s was kind of the ultimate STEM program, right? There wasn't a need for all these different programs because people were so inspired by the space.
Well, there certainly was a need to gradually establish more and more activities and have habitats and stay for longer and longer periods of time and perhaps or move toward a permanent occupancy, but a rotation of crews. Now, you asked, why go to Mars? Well, people will go to Mars. Can you imagine 100 or 1,000 years from now, a leader of an Earth organization of people who has made a commitment to establish a growing settlement colony on Mars? That individual is going to be remembered in history for a tremendous number of years. The inhabitants of Earth have grown up here and increased our capabilities in a magnificent way. But the step between occupying the Earth for all of these hundreds and thousands of years and now beginning to establish a growing settlement of human beings permanently on another planet in the solar system. Now, why permanently? Well, because of the expense, the tremendous additional planning that it takes to bring people back, to have the fuel, to have the launch vehicles, to bring people back for what? For them to train other people? No. For them to write memoirs? For them to become famous back here on Earth? Their purpose of sending people there is to build a colony. And since it is in so many ways clearly best to leave them there, we must build a base on Mars before the people descend for the first time to occupy that base. And the best way to build that base is from a moon of Mars, Phobos. So a considerable number of occupancies of the moon of Mars, while we put together, bring together the elements of a permanent Mars base control complex, just like we have a lunar base control complex, where it's given instructions from a libration point on the backside of the moon. That's how the Earth talks to the base on the far side, and it's not one base, but it's a complex. There's a central location, but there are many rovers and activities that will emanate outward.
Well, let me ask you this. Excuse me. We've only got about 2 minutes left.
Sure.
But I wanted to ask you, you mentioned about how the United States can't, we don't have a rocket capability of launching astronauts into orbit, and then we rely on the Russians. Are we in the middle of a new space race that's more about, what is the complexion? Where there's a commercial aspect to this, there's also international competition with China and then Korea and Japan as well as with Russia. What do you see? Are we into a new space race, I guess, is my question.
Number one, I think we need to establish a healthy cooperation between the United States and China for above the atmosphere, for civil and commercial space activities. And then we need to look at our domestic launch situation and come up with improvements. Right now, among all the possibilities, we have a monopoly between two companies, Boeing and Lockheed, and we have a government facility that wants to design rockets with engineers, propulsion people, all the way to completeness, and then select who would build those. And in the past, it's my opinion that that has not been a good thing for the advancement of competition, free competition, and progress. And so now we have a rocket that was really designed not for its use now, but it was part of the President Bush vision for space exploration called the Ares V. Some changes may have been made, but we now have the Space Launch System, which in the terms of the Congress is consisted in a mandatory way of heritage components. Now, to me, that means old stuff. That means people working in the same jobs they've been doing, so they don't have to come up with a new job. They don't lose their job, and that affects the reelection of politicians in that particular area, and I think that that is deplorable and has been penalizing our space program in the domestic launch capabilities area.
Well, we are going to have to wrap up. It's fascinating. I can keep talking to you because you've got so much experience and so much wisdom. But thank you very, very much for spending some time with us.
Yes, we can do things at the moon that will help us leadership. But it's by not competing with the other nations to land human beings there, but helping the other nations in ways that help us get the capabilities we need to lead the rest of the nations in going to Mars.
Right. Well, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure speaking with Dr. Buzz Aldrin. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Science Insider with David Freeman, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, produced in cooperation with Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com, on the web.